Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
This is part of the oral history of Cheryl Patterson, recorded in February 2020. I was born February 11th, 1956, in Florissant, Missouri, to my parents Juanita Marsnick and Harry Marsnick. I'll get into the family genealogy later. We had a wonderful tiny house. It was two bedrooms, living room, kitchen, and one bath. But the best part was that we had a full basement underneath that was unfinished. And my brother and I would spend countless hours down there playing when it was bad weather outside. My mom would hang the washing down there, too, from the wooden joists in the winter, and it always smelled really good down there, and we'd play underneath that. We had a lot of good neighbors, a lot of kids. We played outdoors. We'd run through the mosquito fogger when it would go through the neighborhood. We rode our bikes. We had a creek that was two houses over from us, and it would flood, and we'd all go out and look at the flooding. We had a large empty field behind us that Al Burke used to grow strawberries and corn in. And he would sell those to us for very little money. And then once we got old enough to need larger areas to play, he would keep the center part untilled, and we'd play baseball and stickball out there in the field. And that was so kind of him to do that for our neighborhood. I'd walk to school through the backyard, and then it was almost a mile away. You had to live a mile away to ride a bus. But that was in the days when little girls wore dresses, and I remember having blue knees with how cold it always was. And that was fun, no matter what the weather. Mom didn't drive a car until I was in my teens. So let's see, what else did we have? Our biggest occasions as a kid were when I went to ride on the Admiral down at the St. Louis Riverfront once when I was a kid. Audrey Sparks was one of the moms that actually drove, and she loaded us all in her car, well overpacked, but that's what you did back then. And I just thought that was wonderful, going up and down the Mississippi River and hearing the calliope. It was just splendid. And one time I went to the zoo and thought that was amazing. When I was 7 years old, I was at my best friend Lisa Pryor's house. Her dad was the neighborhood dentist, and he collected antiques, and the house, we'd call it a hoarder now, but his house was just full of antiques, and in the backyard they had a concrete swimming pool dug in that was always empty, but it was just quirky. It was like an Addams Family house. They had a large antique Victorian coffin in the living room. And we just didn't think anything of it. When Lisa couldn't find the other one of her shoes one day, her mom just said, oh, let's go down to the store and buy you another pair, which was amazing to me because our money was tight, and they just looked on it differently. Well, one day I was at her house playing with her and her older brother, Claude and Robert, and I was climbing on an antique fire truck in her backyard. It was one that was pulled by horses, and they had a huge mastiff dog that was kept in a cage, and it had broken out of regular cages several times. So this was done with iron bars on it, and he was really a nasty dog. But he was locked up, so I wasn't worried about it. Well, her brothers kept teasing that they were going to open the door on the cage, and I got really scared. So as I'm trying to quickly climb down the ladder on the antique fire truck, I slipped and fell on my arm and broke it badly. The bones separated and then went past each other in my arm. Well, the house was locked. There were no parents home. And I couldn't climb over the fence because it was too tall and my arm was hurting too much. So the mom next door came out and gave me two baby aspirin and said, just wait till the mom there got home. Well, I did wait, and she eventually came home. And the next thing I remember was somehow, because mom didn't have a car or drive at that time, somehow somebody got me to the doctor's office where they x-rayed my arm and said it was broken. And I got put on a hanging cast, which was a lot of plaster to make it heavy. And it was cast under the break so that it would pull down on the bones to line them up again. And then I had a sling that was on top of it, not to cradle it, but to let it hang. And I was in first grade, and I remember thinking that I hope that this comes off before summer gets there, because this was in the spring. Hurt like crazy, but that's just the way things go back then. Well, mom told me in later years that the insurance company for the dentist where this happened had called her and said, well, we'd like to give you, in her words, we'd like to give you some money for this. What would you like? And mom didn't know any better. She said, well, I'd like to get my daughter a bed with a mattress and box springs, which none of us had, you know, with a closed box spring. And they said, okay, how much would that cost? And she had said, well, if there was $100, that would probably do everything, which was an exorbitant sum to my mom then. So next thing I knew, I had a twin-size bed with a mattress and box spring, and I just thought that was so special. Years later, I eventually went to Dr. Pryor to get braces, and he was not an orthodontist, and he ended up taking out way too many teeth to make room for it. So I had my braces on till a few weeks before my wedding, and they took the braces off, and within a couple years, my teeth went back to the position where they were because I didn't have any kind of device to keep my teeth from going back. But we paid Dr. Pryor I think it was $100 a month for however long we had that, and he made out like a bandit. And I've lost touch with Lisa, and she was my first really good friend. In our neighborhood at Halloween, all the houses had lights put up. We all felt very safe. We'd go to all the houses and get our candy, and we always had to say a joke or sing a song or something. And we'd walk as far as we could. None of the parents ever went with us, and it was great fun. When we'd play outside at night in the streets, everybody knew that when the street lights came on, it was time to go home. we got street lights when I was about 6 years old, and they put one right in our front yard, and I remember being so amazed. It was a concrete street light that they delivered in our front yard, and I remember watching the street maintenance people putting it up, and we felt so special because we had a street light directly in front of our house. Mom was always generous. She was a stay-at-home mom till my brother and I were teenagers. Back then, you'd get bums every once in a while, because that's what we called them, hobos that would show up at our back door. They wouldn't come to the front door. They'd come to the back door and ask if there were any odd jobs they could do to get something to eat. And I remember Mom would always find something, you know, rake some leaves, sweep the garage, something, so that it wasn't just charity that she was giving. And she would add another cup of soup or cup of water or two to the soup that was always on the stove. And she'd get them bread and iced tea and have them in the house. And they'd sit down and have their soup and bread and tea. And I remember sitting at the table and talking with them. This always happened in the afternoon when the men were all at work, but it was just something that they did. Eventually, as I got older, that sort of thing quit. Mom loved to clean and cook, and she could stretch a nickel better than anybody I knew. Our house was always, the little house was always spick and span. Mom finally went to work when my brother was 13 so that he could buy the kind of clothes in junior high and high school so that he wouldn't look like he came from a blue-collar neighborhood. And that was nice. Dad worked for McDonnell Douglas. He made airplanes. He was a sheet metal worker. They called him a SMAR, sheet metal and riveter, something like that, Dad always said. He always hated the company that he worked for, but he loved his work. He took a great deal of pride in what he did. I remember he'd work double or triple shifts during the Vietnam War, and he'd work on Saturdays and sometimes Saturdays and Sundays because he'd get double and triple time for that. And that was a lot of money that really helped stretch things. We didn't know, I guess nowadays you'd classify us that we grew up poor, but everybody was in the same boat. Most people worked for McDonnell Douglas or Ford, but it was all blue-collar labor in our neighborhood. We had the ubiquitous one family on the block where now we'd say they were abused. The dad, Chubby Van Horn, would drink a lot, and he'd just get part-time jobs where he could, helping out at a store for a while, or always with a little plan going on. Nice enough to all of us in the neighborhood, but he really beat up his family a lot. And everybody knew it was going on, but that was back in the days when nobody said much about it, but we all tried to help out the kids. And they had a whole house full of kids. And for some reason, my dad latched on to the little boy, Paul, who they called Paulie. And he would show up at our house around dinner time. And Mom would make room at the table for him. And he could have some soup and iced tea with us if he'd like, and he always loved that. And then it got to where he was spending a lot of time with my dad in the summers and after school. He'd just go and sit with him in the backyard or sit while my dad worked on his garden in the backyard. And they really bonded. And it helped keep Paulie on the straight and narrow. He had one daughter, he had one sister, Sandy, who was schizophrenic, and she ended up institutionalized. His older sister went on to be a neurologist, getting scholarships And she then went and worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a physician to pay back some of that time. And she moved on and never had contact with the family again. The son, Danny, ended up in jail because he was an arsonist. Even as a little kid, he'd start fires everywhere. And then they had a little girl, Marilyn, who was born with severe hip dysplasia, supposedly from her mom getting beat up while she was pregnant with her. And I remember she would have casts on both legs with the bar in between to separate them, and she'd be toddling around the neighborhood when she first learned how to walk. And then there was a little brother, David, and I don't know what happened to him. But the point of this is my parents were very generous with people, whether it was bums or the abused family. And Polly showed up at my dad's door a few years before they moved away from Florissant. And Polly had been married, had become a Christian, and came by to thank my dad for everything he did for him all growing up. And that just meant the world to my folks that Polly remembered. And by the way, his mom was the person who stood up for me, my godmother, when I went through, had to go through catechism when I was 12 years old, and the priest came in at confirmation. She stood up for me. So just kind of strange links in the area. The family next door were the Knopps, and Dad didn't get along with them at all. There was always that neighborhood feud between the two of them because he said, with a name like Knopp, he was a kraut, and my dad was in World War II. Even though Mr. Knopp was a good, you know, hardworking factory guy, for some reason, my dad never got along with them. They'd call the police on each other if we were having a burning leaves in the backyard or stuff. My dad just didn't get along with him. And his mom's name, the wife's name was Genevieve, that we called Jenny. So the parents didn't get along with each other, but their little boy, Steve, was my best friend. And Steve and I, we never went in each other's houses because that you just didn't do that. But we would play in the creeks and the fields and outside in the yards. I remember we'd set up house underneath the big bushes that grew at the side of his house. And I loved that time. He was just always a ready friend. And that was wonderful. I didn't have any little girls in the neighborhood to play with, but Steve was my buddy then. This was all before we started school. My brother was friends with the Schnedekers down the street, especially Ralph and Frankie, and with Denny Sparks. And they were always at our house. We were the house that everybody came to, that people would have fun at when it was up until about 11 or 12 years old. And they'd just play with me like I was one of the guys. I'd be able to play hot box and baseball and tag and red light, green light, and all those kind of things. One time I was rolling in a cardboard box in the backyard, and one of the Snedeker boys didn't know I was in there. And he ended up kicking me accidentally, and it broke my nose. So that was the first time I ever broke my nose. And boy, did that hurt. But we didn't make a big deal of it. We just got on with things. My nose healed straight. And it was just one of those things that we did. But it was fun. Now, the best part of all is I enjoyed school, really enjoyed school a lot, but wasn't into a heavy social scene. And when I was in 10th, in December 72, I was 16 years old and still in high school. And a friend that I had known, who was a year or two ahead of me, had given my phone number to his college roommate and said, "There's this girl in St. Louis that you might like to ask out for a date." And this was over the Christmas break from college. So I got this phone call out of the blue, and it was from this fellow named Tom Patterson, who was roommates with John Perkins, who I went to high school with. And he asked me out for a date. And I was surprised, but my parents said, okay, I could go as long as I kept a dime in my shoe that I could call from a phone booth if there was anything dicey with them. And they'd come and pick me up no matter where I was. Well, it turned out that on December 30th, 1972, Tom picked me up, and he had a Rambler car, which wasn't in very good shape, and he walked up to the door, and he was wearing some wide horizontal striped shades of blue pants and a flowered shirt and a light blue sport coat and a tie. And I just thought he was splendid. And I was wearing my maroon slacks and a pink sweater with a little white trim on the collar. And he thought I was the best thing he had ever seen at the doorway. And so I introduced him to the folks, and he said he had a wonderful evening planned for us, that we would go to a hockey game, and I had never been to a hockey game, and then we would go out for dinner. And he gave me the idea that he wanted it to be special. So I got in the car with him, and he said, "Be careful where I put my feet," because there was just a cardboard or a mat over the floorboard of the car because it was rusted through. And I also found out that the back seats didn't always stay up, that they would give out and lay you flat. So it was quite interesting, but I was just all agog because I was going out a date with a college man when here I was in high school. And he had this wonderful mustache, and I remember thinking, wow, he's really grown up. Come to find out, he was only 7 months or 5 months older than me, but he got out of school early, graduated early, and I eventually graduated early. So even though we were only 5 months apart in age, he was already ahead of me in college. So we met up with friends of his, Terry Walsh and his date, and then we went to the hockey game as a foursome. And it was funny because neither of us knew that the other one had no idea about hockey. I thought it was the St. Louis Blues playing. We didn't find out until years later when I looked at my ticket that it was an exhibition game with two teams I had never heard of. And I thought, well, hockey must have four quarters. And so after the third quarter, it was getting late. So I got up and used my dime to call the folks and say, I wouldn't be home by 11 because they're just starting the fourth quarter. Well, my folks didn't know anything about hockey either. We didn't know that there's only three periods. So as I got off the phone, I'm walking back and here everybody's leaving. Well, Tom and I ended up laughing and laughing about that. Oh, and by the way, where he took me to dinner first was a place called Noah's Ark, which was a restaurant over the river in St. Charles, Missouri. And it was shaped like a boat, and it was considered just the height of fancy restaurants at the time because they served clam chowder soup at your table in a little serving thing, and they had salad bar, which was a new item, with cold metal plates, and that was considered very fancy. I didn't know how much money he had to spend on me, and he didn't know how much I would spend on the dinner. So I bought the cheapest thing, which was a $4.95 fish, and he bought the cheapest meat thing, which was a $4.95 ground hamburger steak thing. We found that interesting in years later. To jump ahead some, we ended up having our honeymoon at Noah's Ark Inn, where they had built a hotel next to the restaurant by the time we got married 14 months later. And we thought that that was just wonderful, that in time for us to be married, they had put in a hotel. None of that exists anymore. It's all been torn down. And I wish it did. There's a little bit of history there, but it's good to have those good memories of that. Well, back to my timeline. I graduated high school early in December, and I got married 6 weeks later, February 23rd, 1974, in Wickliffe, Kentucky, and then had my wedding on April 6th at what used to be West Florissant Baptist Church, which then moved out to Florissant and became Jamestown Baptist Church. Tom was in college, and I was in college at the University of Missouri, St. Louis at UMSL. We were both on scholarship, but he was on an ROTC scholarship, so that meant I needed to give up my scholarship, back then was the common thought, to be a supporting wife and get a job while he went to his classes at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. So we did that, and he eventually transferred to Washington University in St. Louis, where he completed his degree. He got in a combined degree program, so he finished 3 years of undergraduate study and then 2 years of graduate school studies, getting his master's of social work from Washington University. After that, he went on active duty, and I became a military wife for the rest of the time until he retired from the Army. We had a wonderful life together in the military. It had its ups and downs because he came in right at the end of the Vietnam War, and he got out right around a little after the Persian Gulf Wars started breaking out. I, in the meantime, tried to finish my degree, and it took me 17 years to get my associate's degree by just taking a class here or there as we moved around about as a military wife. It ended up being a good thing, though, because as I had children, they eventually wanted me to be around them a lot, so I became a substitute teacher so I could be with them at their schools. I first substituted in Germany, where we lived, and the kids liked seeing me there. And as it turned out to be something I enjoyed, for the next 20 years, I was a permanent on-call substitute teacher. The most important thing in my life is that I'm a Christian, saved by Jesus Christ, and I trust in him fully. If you had to say a branch of Christianity, I am a Reformed Christian, more of the Calvinist persuasion, not Arminian, and that's very important to me. I grew up Catholic. Mom was a Methodist and Dad was a Catholic, and when they got married, April 17th, 1948, if a Catholic married a non-Catholic, the non-Catholic had to swear that they would switch their religion and raise their children in the Catholic faith. So Mom converted, and we were raised Catholic. Around the time of the Vatican II reforms, Mom and Dad became disillusioned with the church. How can things that were set to be God's law now go at the whim of man? Like it used to be you couldn't eat meat on Friday, so we'd have tomato soup and grilled cheese. But the people in the rich part of town, Ladue, would have lobster and things like that. And Mom and Dad used to think that that was unfair. And then the Catholic Church did away with that. And they said, well, if it's God's law, how can it change? My folks were not very savvy, theologically speaking, and they didn't understand the Catholic Church and all that, but it just put doubts in our minds. Well, I had a friend, Karen Litton and Terry Tucker, and Karen's oldest sister, Verna, was 13 years older than her, and she had a whole lot of kids, and she went to this Baptist church in West Florissant. And she offered to take all of us there. Well, Mom and Dad said I couldn't get out of Mass on Sunday, so I started going to West Florissant Baptist Church on Sunday nights. And that was the first time I was exposed to the gospel and to reading the Bible. And I learned that Jesus saved me, and it wasn't by works, and I couldn't earn my salvation, but that if I was willing to repent of my sins and want to follow him as a true disciple, that I could tell him that I was sorry, repent, and do away with them, and ask him to forgive me and accept me as a disciple, that then I could become a Christian. And this was fantastic news to me. So I did that, became a Christian. The pastor at that time was Gene Curry, and told my parents that I wanted to be baptized, and they talked with me all about it. And Dad came and visited the church once, and they decided that that was okay. I was 13 years old. They thought I was old enough to make that decision. So I did. And after that, I didn't go to the Catholic Church anymore. I was picked up by the church bus and taken to church every Sunday morning and Sunday night. And it really took hold with me. It didn't take hold with my friends, Karen Litton and Terry Tucker and Pat Wiest, which was such a sorrow to me as an adult. But it did stick with me. And it just so happens when I was dating Tom, he was not a Christian at the time. He had been born and raised Catholic also. And when his parents got divorced, he was going for a little while to a public school, because he went to Catholic schools most of his life. But that year he was in public school, and his guidance counselor at school was a man named Gene Curry. And he had had dealt with Tom while he was going through that. Well, lo and behold, when Tom and I are dating, I told him, and we fell in love, and I said, I'm not going to marry anybody who's not a Christian. You know, I can't do that. I had a rudimentary knowledge of Christianity, but I knew that was a big deal. So he started going to church with me, and the first time he went, he was shocked to see who was up there preaching but Gene Curry. And he felt that this was a real sign from God, that this was a man who he knew and that he could trust. So he started going to church with me, and eventually he made a decision, and God saved him, and so we could get married. Then as time went on, I started to read and study more and more about the Bible and get deeper and deeper into it, because I knew that if I wasn't seeing growth, then I wasn't a Christian. It was a false profession. But I just longed to read the Bible, and I longed to learn more, so I knew I was truly saved. But a lot of that didn't, it took a long time to percolate through. And finally, in, 20 to 30 years later, I finally started getting more and more teaching and realizing how holy God was. And one time we were living in Arkansas then for Tom's work, and I was driving down the highway, and I was just smacked upside my mental head with how holy God was and that I was shortchanging him. And that really produced a difference in me, a different level of attention with God. And that was very special for me. And just my whole attitude towards everything was then, does this please God or not? You know, not as a works-based thing, but because I love him so much, I wanted to make sure I was honoring him. So that was a different perspective on things. So that's how I've been since that time. And I keep growing closer and closer. And that has informed all the stuff I've gone through in my life, with the good times and the tragic times. So I would say that's my most important characteristic, and the thing I'm most pleased with, because I have a view that eternity is long and life is short. So what I do better have an eternal ramification. So that's it on that part. Now let me come to the part on having children. Tom and I, we married when we were 18, and he was still in college, and at that point we didn't want to have kids. Just not at all. We were very happy, very wrapped up in each other, very much in love. As I might say, we still are, now that it's 46 years later. We are still wrapped up in each other and still very much in love. So we are one of the 18-year-olds getting married that goes to show that it can be worth it. And so we waited. We got married in 74, and we finally decided in 1980, well, maybe it wouldn't be so bad to have a child. Maybe that would work out. So we tried and tried, and I wasn't getting pregnant. And I didn't expect that to happen. And then I finally got pregnant and wasn't very far along when I had a first trimester miscarriage in January of 1980. And I thought, well, that's one child ahead of me in heaven, but we're going to keep trying, because I had researched and found it wasn't that unusual to have a miscarriage the first time around. Well, lo and behold, I got pregnant right away again and gave birth to my first son, Scott Patterson, on New Year's Eve, 1980, at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And he was such a joy. I was in labor for 39 hours. I had a Filipino doctor who really wasn't very considerate of women and didn't really realize that Scott was stuck and that he wasn't going to go anywhere. So when his shift was over after those 3 days and another doctor came on board, he said, "Oh my goodness, this shouldn't happen." And they rushed me in for an emergency cesarean section. So Scott was born with a big bruise on the top of his head, but I was safe and he was safe and he was my New Year's Eve baby. We named him Scott Thomas Arthur Patterson and decided a couple years later that it might be nice to have a brother or sister for him. So we were still at Fort Leonard Wood when I got pregnant with Craig. And he was Craig Edward Stewart Patterson, and he was born in April 1983. And when he was just 2.5 weeks old, he developed spinal meningitis. And it was not known if he would survive it or not at that young of an age. And so I stayed in the hospital with him while we were in the middle of a move to San Antonio, Texas for the Army. And Tom took Scott to work every day, and his sergeant would help look after him and his secretary. And Scott was just so sweet and such a joy to be with. But Craig came through okay. And then he was discharged, and we all moved down to San Antonio, Texas. After we were in San Antonio for our course with the military, we got orders to go to Germany. So Craig was only a few months old, and I was staying in St. Louis waiting to join Tom in Germany when I had to go down to the Mart building in St. Louis to get my shots that you had to get then to go overseas. And they have to do at that time they did a mandatory pregnancy test. And I said, "No, I just had a baby. I'm not pregnant." But they said, "Well, we have to do this and then you can come back the next day and get your shots." So I got my shots for Scott, and Craig was too little to get any. We'd get his over in Germany. So I'm sitting at my mom's and dad's house that afternoon, and I get a call from the clinic at the Mart building that said, "Well, you're pregnant." And I said, "No, I can't be. You know, I'm nursing my baby. They said, "Well, you are pregnant. You can't get your shots." And so I went down to the Mart building right then, got the results of the pregnancy test, and thought, "Wow, we're having a third child," because we really hadn't given any thought to having any more. We just, you know, like most people in that time, we had two, and we just didn't think anything of having a third child, but God had other plans. So I got a hold of Tom in Germany and told him we were pregnant. And then shortly after, I got on the plane with my newborn and my toddler and me pregnant and went over to Germany. And while I was in Germany, in Butzbach, Germany, I went to the 97th General Hospital in Frankfurt and gave birth in September 84 to our daughter, Laura. So she was born in Germany. We opted not to have dual citizenship, so she was just 100% American with a State Department passport and birth certificate. So that's how I ended up having three children. And when she was born, we had said no more. So they went ahead and did stuff so I wouldn't have any more kids. So that was our quiver of children being complete. Let me give you a little family history now. My dad was Harry Marsnick. He was born to a man and woman that came over from Croatia, from a little village around Fiume, Croatia, at that time. He was born at 5645 Hodamont Avenue, which was in Jennings. His mom was Josephine Marsnick. Her Croatian name was Pepa Zaharia, and his dad was Lovra Marsnick, and he went by Larry in the United States. My grandpa Larry, whom I never met, was born in Croatia but died in America in the 1940s. My grandma, Josephine, born in Croatia, she didn't die until 1969, and she's buried at Calvary Cemetery in St. Louis. We don't know any more history on Larry Marsnick other than he came from Croatia and that he was said to have lots of brothers and sisters. But Dad said he never heard any talk of his own grandparents or aunts or uncles or anybody. Grandpa Larry was a concrete worker, and he worked and built many of the concrete things in St. Louis in the 1920s and 30s and early 40s. He had his own concrete company, and he built retaining walls and large city kind of structures. Then he had a son, Rudy, that was in the concrete business with him, and he always wanted my dad, Harry, and his brother, Charlie, to go in with him, but Dad ended up in the airplane manufacturing business, and his brother, Charlie, ended up at Cry Packing House, and eventually, after Larry died, his older brother, Rudy, went into home construction. They also had a sister, Lena, and she was a stay-at-home wife and mother. Josephine Zaharia, we did a little history looking, and she had, her mother was Anna, and on her birth certificate, it said she was from Hungary. But the trouble we have with all the birth certificates and death certificates and marriage licenses from Larry and Josephine and further back is the same land that they lived on is listed as Italian, Austrian, Hungarian, Austro-Hungarian, Italian, and Croatian. And that's for the same place. So it's a little confusing for us to know where people were born in and from. On my mom's side, Juanita Kalinowski, she was born and raised in downtown St. Louis. And her parents were Joe Kalinowski, not Joseph, but Joe, and Thelma Viola Morris. And Joe Kalinowski was born in St. Louis, and Thelma Morris was born in Wellsville, Missouri. We know that Joe Kalinowski's dad, Anthony Kalinowski, had jumped ship. He had been a stoker on a steamship coming from Europe, from Germany to New York City. And when they landed there, he jumped ship, like many of the people did in his day. He had been in Poland, where he lived, in Plock, Poland, and he was in the Tsar's army, conscripted. Well, that was not a very pleasant thing back then. This was back in the 1880s. So he said he had to go home and visit his mother because she was dying. And they gave him a leave from the Russian army. And his home was over the river, they said, that separated then Russia from Poland. That's the stuff that's been handed down. So he got to his home. His mother wasn't dying. That was all made up. And he was able to make his way to port in Germany, where he got the job as the stoker. He did become a U.S. citizen later on. And he eventually, Anthony Kalinowski, which would be my great-grandfather, eventually died around 1932 or 33 in St. Louis. Other than that, we don't know any further back on Joe Kalinowski's side. So that's a dead end. My grandpa Joe had a lot of siblings. The only one I really knew was his brother, Tony. He was named Anthony, same as their dad. And a bit of interesting things about Tony was I just knew him as a paralyzed man from the waist down who lived on the second floor in a little house on Angelica in downtown St. Louis. And when I was a little girl, Dad would take my grandpa, Joe, down to visit him a few times a year, and I would tag along. And it was very much in a ghetto, rundown area. And I always wondered what Anthony did for a living and how come he was paralyzed. Well, it wasn't until I was an adult that I found out he had been paralyzed, they said, by a bullet in the Roaring Twenties or something, and that he had worked as a minor functionary for the Italian mafia in St. Louis. And that's how he had made his living at that time. And that now, as he was a very old man when I knew him, he acted as a bit of a fence for minor criminals who would bring stuff up to his second floor flat, and where they'd find stuff that accidentally fell off trucks and such. And somehow from that apartment, he would find buyers and all. But what a shady history. No wonder my mom never went to see him and really didn't like us going there very much. But it is a bit colorful. My grandpa Joe was a machinist all his life, and he had worked in a factory that manufactured part of the Norden bomb sight that was so useful during World War II. He was a tool and die man. When we lived over in Bremerhaven, Germany, Tom and I used to go see historical things, museums, things associated with any kind of wars, from Napoleonic to World War II and whatever. Well, one time we were in Schwanewede, which is outside of Bremen, and there was an area there that had a submarine pen where they would had submarine activity going on. but they used slave labor from many places, Jewish and Polish. And they had a cemetery set up there where they buried some of the people that died working as slave laborers there in Schwanewede, Germany. And the first tombstone we came up to, we brushed away the weeds on it, and it said A. Kalinowski. And we were just amazed, because Kalinowski isn't that common a name. So it must have been one of our relatives that had been worked to death there. So that's a little bit of history there. On my mom's side, for Thelma Viola Morris, one of my mom's sisters, Marcella, had done extensive genealogy work back in the 1970s. And she was able to trace my grandma Thelma back to Charlemagne. So we have extensive history on her through the Morris line. One of the interesting stories growing up was that my grandma Morris, her father was a Warfield, and the story was always told that we were distantly related to the Duchess of Windsor, who was referred to as that woman of Wallace Warfield Simpson, who eventually married the King of England, and he abdicated for her. And that was through the Warfield Morris line. And William Henry Morris, who was my grandma's dad, he was the superintendent of the clay mines in Wellsville, Missouri. And my mom used to love going out and visiting with him back when she was a little girl. And he had a brother named Jewel, and I mean a son named Jewel, and he worked in the clay mine too. And back in the 1920s, one of the fuses on the dynamite they used to blow up the clay mine was too short, and my uncle Jewel had it explode in front of him, and he lost his sight. And I used to visit him in Wellsville, and he was so much fun. He constantly had a smile, and he always wanted people to ask him what time it was, because he had a watch that had Braille on it, and he loved to open that up and give people the time. He felt very proud of that. He also used phrases like, "Oh, it's good to see ya," or "You're looking good." Just a happy-go-lucky guy. Dodging back here. Yeah, on Lover and Peta, who are Larry and Josephine Zaharia, I eventually, through Ancestry.com, made contact with someone who said they were descended from some of their cousins that my dad never knew. And one time, the Nazis during World War II came to Fiuma, and they were looking for information for something that had happened. And they couldn't get any answers, so they had all the men in the village line up around the fountain. And they said, "Okay, we're just going to kill some of these people if you don't give us answers." And the Nazis then went ahead and killed two of the people that would have been my great uncles. And Lovra, at that time, ran a little grocery store and pub in the little village that existed in the little town. But there wasn't any future there, so he came to the U.S. in New York back before 1890s, and then he sent for Pepa, who would be his bride, and she came in to America through New Orleans by a ship up to St. Louis. When they set up house on Hoodeman Avenue in Jennings, they dug out a basement and just kept it as dirt, and that was their kitchen. And then slowly they added on to the house as they had kids. They built an above-ground room, and then as they had more kids, they would add another room. And the house was still standing, last I knew. They had goats. This is in a regular city, but back then. And my grandpa would make wine from the grapes that he grew. During the 1920s, he had a still that he would hide in the backyard when the revenuers were going to come around, and then get back out again. My grandma never did learn to speak English very well. About one of the few things she would say in English were, "Damn Serbs." And I was 13 when she died, so I have no idea what that meant, what her relation was between the Croatians and Serbs and all. But that's just a little bit of interesting history there.